Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis, continuing on cassette number 4, side 1. When he recollected himself, they were all on shore, wet, steaming, trembling with exertion, and embracing one another. It did not now seem strange to him to be clasped to a beast of wet fur. The breath of the Hrossa, which, though sweet, was not human breath, did not offend him. He was one with them. That difficulty which they, accustomed to more than one rational species, had perhaps never felt, was now overcome. They were all Hnahu. They had stood shoulder to shoulder in the face of an enemy, and the shapes of their heads no longer mattered. And he, even Ransom, had come through it and not been disgraced. He had grown up. They were on a little promontory free of forest, on which they had run aground in the confusion of the fight. The wreckage of the boat and the corpse of the monster lay confused together in the water beside them. No sound from the rest of the hunting party was audible. They had been almost a mile ahead when they met the Hnakra. All three sat down to recover their breath. "So," said Khoi, "we are Hnakra Punti. This is what I have wanted all my life." At that moment, Ransom was deafened by a loud sound, a perfectly familiar sound, which was the last thing he expected to hear. It was a terrestrial, human, and civilized sound. It was even European. It was the crack of an English rifle, and Hjoy, at his feet, was struggling to rise and gasping. There was blood on the white weed where he struggled. Ransom dropped on his knees beside him. The huge body of the Hross was too heavy for him to turn round. Wynne helped him. "Hjoy, can you hear me?" said Ransom, with his face close to the round, seal-like head. "Hjoy, it is through me that this has happened. It is the other Hamana who have hit you, the bent two that brought me to Malacandra. They can throw death at a distance with the thing they have made. I should have told you. We are all a bent race. We have come here to bring evil on Malacandra. We are only half Hnahu. Hjoy." His speech died away into the inarticulate. He did not know the words for forgive, or shame, or fault. Hardly the word for sorry. He could only stare into Hjoy's distorted face in speechless guilt. But the Hross seemed to understand. It was trying to say something, and Ransom laid his ear close to the working mouth. Hjoy's dulling eyes were fixed on his own, but the expression of a Hross was not even now perfectly intelligible to him. "Na, ma," it muttered. And then, at last, "Man, Hnakra Punt." Then there came a contortion of the whole body, a gush of blood and saliva from the mouth. His arms gave way under the sudden dead weight of the sagging head, and Hjoy's face became as alien and animal as it had seemed at their first meeting. The glazed eyes and the slowly stiffening, bedraggled fur were like those of any dead beast found in an earthly wood. Ransom resisted an infantile impulse to break out into imprecations on Weston and Devine. Instead, he raised his eyes to meet those of Wynne, who was crouching, Hrossa do not kneel, on the other side of the corpse. "I am in the hands of your people, Wynne," he said. "They must do as they will. But if they are wise, they will kill me, and certainly they will kill the other two." "One does not kill Hnahu," said Wynne. "Only Oyasa does that. But these other, where are they?" Ransom glanced around. It was open on the promontory, but thick wood came down to where it joined the mainland, perhaps 200 yards away. "Somewhere in the wood," he said. "Lie down, Wynne, here where the ground is lowest. They may throw from their thing again." He had some difficulty in making Wynne do as he suggested. When both were lying on dead ground, their feet almost in the water, the Hross spoke again. "Why did they kill him?" he asked. "They would not know he was Hnahu," said Ransom. "I have told you that there is only one kind of Hnahu in our world. They would think he was a beast. If they thought that, they would kill him for pleasure, or in fear, or," he hesitated, "because they were hungry. But I must tell you the truth, Wynne. They would kill even a Hnahu, knowing it to be Hnahu, if they thought its death would serve them." There was a short silence. "I am wondering," said Ransom, "if they saw me. It is for me they are looking. Perhaps if I went to them they would be content and come no farther into your land. But why do they not come out of the wood to see what they have killed?" "Our people are coming," said Wynne, turning his head. Ransom looked back and saw the lake black with boats. The main body of the hunt would be with them in a few minutes. "They are afraid of the Hrosser," said Ransom. "That is why they do not come out of the wood. I will go to them, Wynne." "No," said Wynne, "I have been thinking. All this has come from not obeying the Eldil. He said you were to go to Oyarsa. You ought to have been already on the road. You must go now." "But that will leave the bent Hamana here. They may do more harm." "They will not set on the Hrosser. You have said they are afraid. It is more likely that we will come upon them. Never fear, they will not see us or hear us. We will take them to Oyarsa. But you must go now, as the Eldil said." "Your people will think I have run away because I am afraid to look in their faces after Hjor's death." "It is not a question of thinking, but of what an Eldil says. This is cub's talk. Now listen, and I will teach you the way." The Hross explained to him that 5 days' journey to the south, the Handramit joined another Handramit, and 3 days up this other Handramit to west and north was Meldilorn and the seat of Oyarsa. But there was a shorter way, a mountain road, across the corner of the Harandra between the two canyons, which would bring him down to Meldilorn on the second day. He must go into the wood before them and through it till he came to the mountain wall of the Handramit. And he must work south along the roots of the mountains till he came to a road cut up between them. Up this he must go, and somewhere beyond the tops of the mountains he would come to the Tower of Ogre. Ogre would help him. He could cut weed for his food before he left the forest and came into the rock country. Wynne realized that Ransom might meet the other two Hamana as soon as he entered the wood. "If they catch you," he said, "then it will be as you say. They will come no farther into our land. But it is better to be taken on your way to Oyarsa than to stay here. And once you are on the way to him, I do not think he will let the Bent Ones stop you." Ransom was by no means convinced that this was the best plan, either for himself or for the Hrosser. But the stupor of humiliation in which he had lain ever since Hjoy fell forbade him to criticize. He was anxious only to do whatever they wanted him to do, to trouble them as little as was now possible, and above all, to get away. It was impossible to find out how Wynne felt, and Ransom sternly repressed an insistent, whining impulse to renewed protestations and regrets, self-accusations that might elicit some word of pardon. Hjoy, with his last breath, had called him Hanakra Slayer. That was forgiveness generous enough, and with that he must be content. As soon as he had mastered the details of his route, he bade farewell to Wynne and advanced alone towards the forest. Chapter 14. Until he reached the wood, Ransom found it difficult to think of anything except the possibility of another rifle bullet from Weston or Devine. He thought that they probably still wanted him alive rather than dead, and this, combined with the knowledge that a Hross was watching him, enabled him to proceed with at least external composure. Even when he had entered the forest, he felt himself in considerable danger. The long, branchless stems made cover only if you were very far away from the enemy, and the enemy in this case might be very close. He became aware of a strong impulse to shout out to Weston and Devine and give himself up. It rationalized itself in the form that this would remove them from the district, as they would probably take him off to the Sorns and leave the Hrosser unmolested. But Ransom knew a little psychology and had heard of the hunted man's irrational instinct to give himself up. Indeed, he had felt it himself in dreams. It was some such trick, he thought, that his nerves were now playing him. In any case, he was determined henceforward to obey the Hrosser, or Eldilla. His efforts to rely on his own judgment in Malacandra had so far ended tragically enough. He made a strong resolution, defying in advance all changes of mood, that he would faithfully carry out the journey to Meldilorn if it could be done. This resolution seemed to him all the more certainly right, because he had the deepest misgivings about that journey. He understood that the Harandra, which he had to cross, was the home of the Sorns. In fact, He was walking of his own free will into the very trap that he had been trying to avoid ever since his arrival on Malacandra. Here, the first change of mood tried to raise its head. He thrust it down. And even if he got through the Sorns and reached Meldilorn, who or what might Oyasa be? Oyasa, Wynn had ominously observed, did not share the Hrossa's objection to shedding the blood of a Hnahu. And again, Oyasa ruled Thorns as well as Hrossa and Pipifeltrigi. Perhaps he was simply the Arch-Sorn. And now came the second change of mood. Those old terrestrial fears of some alien, cold intelligence, superhuman in power, subhuman in cruelty, which had utterly faded from his mind among the Hrossa, rose clamoring for readmission. But he strode on. He was going to Meldilorn. It was not possible, he told himself, that the Hrossa should obey an evil or monstrous creature. And they had told him, or had they, he was not quite sure, that Oyasa was not a Sorn. Was Oyasa a god? Perhaps that very idol to whom the Sorns wanted to sacrifice him. But the Hrossa, though they said strange things about him, clearly denied that he was a god. There was one god, according to them, Maleldil, the young. Nor was it possible to imagine Hjoy or Nohra worshipping a blood-stained idol. Unless, of course, the Hrossa were, after all, under the thumb of the Sorns, superior to their masters in all the qualities that human beings value, but intellectually inferior to them and dependent on them. It would be a strange, but not an inconceivable world. Heroism and poetry at the bottom, cold scientific intellect above it, and overtopping all, some dark superstition which scientific intellect, helpless against the revenge of the emotional depths it had ignored, had neither will nor power to remove. A mumbo-jumbo. But Ransom pulled himself up. He knew too much now to talk that way. He and all his class would have called the Eldila a superstition if they had been merely described to them, but now he had heard the voice himself. No, Oyasa was a real person, if he was a person at all. He had now been walking for about an hour, and it was nearly midday. No difficulty about his direction had yet occurred. He had merely to keep going uphill, and he was certain of coming out of the forests to the mountain wall sooner or later. Meanwhile, he felt remarkably well, though greatly chastened in mind. The silent, purple half-light of the woods spread all around him as it had spread on the first day he spent in Malacandra, but everything else was changed. He looked back on that time as on a nightmare, on his own mood at that time as a sort of sickness. Then all had been whimpering, unanalyzed, self-nourished, self-consuming dismay. Now, in the clear light of an accepted duty, he felt fear, indeed, but with it a sober sense of confidence in himself and in the world, and even an element of pleasure. It was the difference between a landsman in a sinking ship and a horseman on a bolting horse. Either may be killed, but the horseman is an agent as well as a patient. About an hour after noon, he suddenly came out of the wood into bright sunshine. He was only 20 yards from the almost perpendicular bases of the mountain spires, too close to them to see their tops. A sort of valley ran up in the re-entrant between two of them at the place where he had emerged, an unclimbable valley consisting of a single concave sweep of stone, which in its lower parts ascended steeply as the roof of a house, and farther up seemed almost vertical. At the top it even looked as if it hung over a bit, like a tidal wave of stone at the very moment of breaking. But this, he thought, might be an illusion. He wondered what the Hrossa's idea of a road might be. He began to work his way southward along the narrow, broken ground between wood and mountain. Great spurs of the mountains had to be crossed every few moments, and even in that lightweight world it was intensely tiring. After about half an hour he came to a stream. Here he went a few paces into the forest, cut himself an ample supply of the ground weed, and sat down beside the water's edge for lunch. When he had finished, he filled his pockets with what he had not eaten, and proceeded. He began soon to be anxious about his road, for if he could make the top at all, he could do it only by daylight, and the middle of the afternoon was approaching. But his fears were unnecessary. When it came, it was unmistakable. An open way through the wood appeared on the left. He must be somewhere behind the Hross village now. And on the right, he saw the road, a single ledge, or in places, a trench, cut sidewise and upwards across the sweep of such a valley as he had seen before. It took his breath away. The insanely steep, hideously narrow staircase without steps, leading up and up from where he stood to where it was an almost invisible thread on the pale green surface of the rock. But there was no time to stand and look at it. He was a poor judge of heights, but he had no doubt that the top of the road was removed from him by a more than alpine distance. It would take him at least till sundown to reach it. Instantly he began the ascent. Such a journey would have been impossible on Earth. The first quarter of an hour would have reduced a man of Ransom's build and age to exhaustion. Here he was at first delighted with the ease of his movement, and then staggered by the gradient and length of the climb, which, even under Malachandrian conditions, soon bowed his back and gave him an aching chest and trembling knees. But this was not the worst. He heard already a singing in his ears, and noticed that despite his labor there was no sweat on his forehead. The cold, increasing at every step, seemed to sap his vitality worse than any heat could have done. Already his lips were cracked. His breath, as he panted, showed like a cloud. His fingers were numb. He was cutting his way up into a silent, Arctic world, and had already passed from an English to a Lapland winter. It frightened him, and he decided that he must rest here or not at all. 100 paces more, and if he sat down, he would sit forever. He squatted on the road for a few minutes, slapping his body with his arms. The landscape was terrifying. Already the Hadramit, which had made his world for so many weeks, was only a thin purple cleft sunk amidst the boundless level desolation of the Herandra, which now, on the farthest side, showed clearly between and above the mountain peaks. But long before he was rested, he knew that he must go on or die. The world grew stranger. Among the Hrossa he had almost lost the feeling of being on a strange planet. Here it returned upon him with a desolating force. It was no longer the world, scarcely even a world. It was a planet, a star, a waste place in the universe, millions of miles from the world of men. It was impossible to recall what he had felt about Hjoy, or Hwin, or the Eldila, or Oyarsa. It seemed fantastic to have thought he had duties to such hobgoblins, if they were not hallucinations, met in the wilds of space. He had nothing to do with them. He was a man. Why had Weston and Devine left him alone like this? But all the time, the old resolution, taken when he could still think, was driving him up the road. Often he forgot where he was going and why. The movement became a mechanical rhythm, from weariness to stillness, from stillness to unbearable cold, from cold to motion again. He noticed that the Hadramit, now an insignificant part of the landscape, was full of a sort of haze. He had never seen a fog while he was living there. Perhaps that was what the air of the Hadramit looked like from above. Certainly it was a different air from this. There was something more wrong with his lungs and heart than even the cold and the exertion accounted for. And though there was no snow, there was an extraordinary brightness. The light was increasing, sharpening and growing whiter, and the sky was a much darker blue than he had ever seen on Malachandra. Indeed, it was darker than blue. It was almost black, and the jagged spires of rock standing against it were like his mental picture of a lunar landscape. Some stars were visible. Suddenly he realized the meaning of these phenomena. There was very little air above him. He was near the end of it. The Malachandrian atmosphere lay chiefly in the Hadramits. The real surface of the planet was naked or thinly clad. The stabbing sunlight and the black sky above him were that heaven out of which he had dropped into the Malachandrian world, already showing through the last thin veil of air. If the top were more than 100 feet away, it would be where no man could breathe at all. He wondered whether the Hrossa had different lungs and had sent him by a road that meant death for man. But even while he thought of this, he took note that those jagged peaks blazing in sunlight against an almost black sky were level with him. He was no longer ascending, and on his right by a smooth ascending swell of stone that ran up to the true Herandra. And where he was, he could still breathe, though gasping, dizzy and in pain. The blaze in his eyes was worse. The sun was setting. The Hrossa must have foreseen this. They could not live any more than he on the Herandra by night. Still staggering forward, he looked about him for any sign of Augre's tower, whatever Augre might be. Doubtless he exaggerated the time during which he thus wandered and watched the shadows from the rocks lengthening towards him. It cannot really have been long before he saw a light ahead, a light which showed how dark the surrounding landscape had become. He tried to run, but his body would not respond. Stumbling in haste and weakness, he made for the light. Thought he had reached it and found that it was far farther than he had supposed. Almost despaired, staggered on again, and came at last to what seemed a cavern mouth. The light within was an unsteady one, and a delicious wave of warmth smote on his face. It was firelight. He came into the mouth of the cave, and then, unsteadily, round the fire into the interior, and stood still blinking in the light. When at last he could see, he discerned a smooth chamber of green rock, very lofty. There were two things in it. One of them, dancing on the wall and roof, was the huge, angular shadow of a Sorn. The other, crouching beneath it, was the Sorn himself. Chapter 15. "Come in, small one," boomed the Sorn. "Come in and let me look at you." Now that he stood face to face with the spectre that had haunted him ever since he had set foot on Malacandra, Ransom felt a surprising indifference. He had no idea what might be coming next, but he was determined to carry out his program, and in the meantime the warmth and more breathable air were a heaven in themselves. He came in, well in past the fire, and answered the Sorn. His own voice sounded to him a shrill treble. "The Hwasa have sent me to look for Oyarsa," he said. The Sorn peered at him.
"You are not from this world," it said suddenly.
"No," replied Ransom, and sat down. He was too tired to explain.
"I think you are from Thulcandra, small one," said the Sorn.
"Why?" said Ransom.
"You are small and thick, and that is how the animals ought to be made in a heavier world. You cannot come from Glundandra, for it is so heavy that if any animals could live there, they would be flat like plates. Even you, small one, would break if you stood up on that world. I do not think you are from Paralandra, for it must be very hot. If any came from there, they would not live when they arrived here. So I conclude you are from Thulcandra."
"The world I come from is called Earth by those who live there," said Ransom, "and it is much warmer than this. Before I came into your cave, I was nearly dead with cold and thin air." The Sorn made a sudden movement with one of its long forelimbs. Ransom stiffened, though he did not allow himself to retreat, for the creature might be going to grab him. In fact, its intentions were kindly. Stretching back into the cave, it took from the wall what looked like a cup. Then Ransom saw that it was attached to a length of flexible tube. The Sorn put it into his hands.
"Smell on this," it said. "The Hwasa also need it when they pass this way."
Ransom inhaled and was instantly refreshed. His painful shortness of breath was eased, and the tension of chest and temples was relaxed. The Sorn and the lighted cavern, hitherto vague and dreamlike to his eyes, took on a new reality. "Oxygen?" he asked, but naturally the English word meant nothing to the Sorn. "Are you called Ogrey?" he asked.
"Yes," said the Sorn. "What are you called?"
"The animal I am is called Man, and therefore the Hwasa call me Haman, but my own name is Ransom."
"Man, Ransom," said the Sorn.
He noticed that it spoke differently from the Hwasa, without any suggestion of their persistent initial H. It was sitting on its long, wedge-shaped buttocks, with its feet drawn close up to it. A man in the same posture would have rested his chin on his knees, but the Sorn's legs were too long for that. Its knees rose high above its shoulders on each side of its head, grotesquely suggestive of huge ears, and the head, down between them, rested its chin on the protruding breast. The creature seemed to have either a double chin or a beard. Ransom could not make out which in the firelight. It was mainly white or cream in color, and seemed to be clothed down to the ankles in some soft substance that reflected the light. On the long, fragile shanks, where the creature was closest to him,
He saw that this was some natural kind of coat. It was not like fur, but more like feathers. In fact, it was almost exactly like feathers. The whole animal, seen at close quarters, was less terrifying than he had expected, and even a little smaller. The face, it was true, took a good deal of getting used to. It was too long, too solemn, and too colorless, and it was much more unpleasantly like a human face than any inhuman creature's face ought to be. Its eyes, like those of all very large creatures, seemed too small for it. But it was more grotesque than horrible. A new conception of the Sorns began to arise in his mind. The ideas of giant and ghost receded behind those of goblin and gawk.
"Perhaps you are hungry, small one," it said.
Ransom was. The Sorn rose with strange, spidery movements and began going to and fro about the cave, attended by its thin goblin shadow. It brought him the usual vegetable foods of Malacandra and strong drink, with the very welcome addition of a smooth brown substance which revealed itself to nose, eye, and palate, in defiance of all probability, as cheese. Ransom asked what it was. The Sorn began to explain painfully how the female of some animals secreted a fluid for the nourishment of its young, and would have gone on to describe the whole process of milking and cheese-making if Ransom had not interrupted it.
"Yes, yes," he said, "we do the same on Earth. What is the beast you use?"
"It is a yellow beast with a long neck. It feeds on the forests that grow in the Handramit. The young ones of our people who are not yet fit for much else drive the beasts down there in the mornings and follow them while they feed. Then before night they drive them back and put them in the caves."
For a moment Ransom found something reassuring in the thought that the Sorns were shepherds. Then he remembered that the Cyclops in Homer plied the same trade.
"I think I have seen one of your people at this very work," he said. "But the Hrossa, they let you tear up their forests?"
"Why should they not?"
"Do you rule the Hrossa?"
"Oyarsa rules them."
"And who rules you?"
"Oyarsa."
"But you know more than the Hrossa."
"The Hrossa know nothing except about poems and fish and making things grow out of the ground."
"And Oyarsa, is he a Sorn?"
"No, no, small one. I have told you he rules all Nahu."
So he pronounced Nahu.
"And everything in Malacandra."
"I do not understand this Oyarsa," said Ransom. "Tell me more."
"Oyarsa does not die," said the Sorn. "And he does not breed. He is the one of his kind who was put into Malacandra to rule it when Malacandra was made. His body is not like ours, nor yours. It is hard to see, and the light goes through it."
"Like an Eldil?"
"Yes, he is the greatest of Eldila who ever come to Ahandra."
"What are these Eldila?"
"Do you tell me, small one, that there are no Eldila in your world?"
The story is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.